From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a proposed hospital merger promises to reduce costs and increase access to patients, but could it do just the opposite?
My concerns are that this merger will result in increased disparities, increased costs, while reducing access, especially for underserved communities.
Also today, Attorney General Maura Healey on her recent victories against ExxonMobil and her criminal investigation into the state police overtime fraud case.
If state AGs don't have the authority to do investigations, to look into allegations of civil or criminal violations, then we're going to be in deep trouble.
Kendrick Lamar won the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for Music, the first time the award has gone to a hip-hop artist. We'll ask what took him so long. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Pulitzer Prize Committee did something it's never done before until yesterday, when it awarded the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for Music to a hip-hop artist, Kendrick Lamar.
I said I'm deep and I'm fired up. All I want tonight is just get higher.
That's Lamar's song Loyalty, featuring Rihanna, from his album Damn. Now, Lamar is the first non-classical and non-jazz musician to ever win the Pulitzer Prize for Music. And in its announcement about the win, the Pulitzer Committee called Kendrick Lamar's album a virtuosic song collection that offers affecting vignettes capturing the complexity of modern African-American life. Well, hip-hop has always been political, and it's always been a voice of modern African-American life. So I'm wondering, what took the Pulitzer Committee so long? Joining us now with perhaps an answer, or at least her take, is Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor as well. Renee, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, what was your reaction when you heard yesterday that Kendrick Lamar had won the Pulitzer Prize?
Well, like every other journalist in America, I was watching the Pulitzer results come in, and when it popped up that Kendrick Lamar had won for music, I literally yelped out loud and stood up and screamed out, "Kendrick Lamar won the Pulitzer for music!" And everyone just sort of stared at me, because, I mean, no one saw it coming, and that was the thing. I mean, it was wonderful because he's a great artist, but no one would have ever expected the Pulitzer Committee to give its music prize to a hip-hop artist.
Yeah, and it's especially interesting or affecting because Lamar didn't win the Grammy for Album of the Year in January, so he's gotten at least a recognition from the Pulitzer Committee, if not the Grammy Committee.
Well, you know, I kind of joked that, you know, the only reason he won the Pulitzer is because Bruno Mars wasn't nominated. You know, it was a big deal back in January. Everyone assumed Kendrick Lamar was going to win Album of the Year. He's been nominated three consecutive years for Album of the Year and has lost every single time. And people thought this was going to be it, and it didn't happen. And, you know, people were pretty upset about that. It made the Grammys seem extraordinarily out of touch. And here we then have the Pulitzers, who seem much more on point than the Grammys.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, though. I mean, Kendrick Lamar is already a music superstar, right? So he's probably honored by this award. He doesn't necessarily need it. So I'm just wondering, you know, who is this really for? Is this for Lamar, or is it for, you know, people who may not listen to his music so much to draw their attention to him?
Well, there's an argument to be made that the Pulitzers need Kendrick Lamar more than Kendrick Lamar needs the Pulitzer.
Yeah.
You know, however, recognition matters. You know, this is why people cared about the Grammys. So people should care as much about Kendrick winning a Pulitzer as they cared about him not winning Album of the Year. You know, it does matter. You know, he's sold millions of records. He sells out concert venues everywhere. Every performance on TV is, you know, a big deal. But it matters when a group like this recognizes what you do. You know, it doesn't legitimize him, and I want to be clear about that. He doesn't need to be legitimized, nor does hip-hop. But I do think that recognition matters. You know, that's the purpose of awards. And you know, I do think it matters that he is a Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yeah, I mean, I want to hear some more of the music in just a second here. But to your point about it's not legitimizing hip-hop just because the Pulitzers have decided to get woke, if I can put it that way. But I mean, it's not exactly that the committee has been, or the committees over the years have been all that progressive. I mean, it wasn't until 1997 when they awarded Wynton Marsalis the Pulitzer for music, and he was the first non-classical artist to win it.
You know, and at that point, they had been giving out music Pulitzers for 50 years, and it took them that long to finally get around. If you think of all the jazz artists between 1943, when the first music Pulitzer was awarded, and 1997, when Wynton Marsalis wins, you're talking about Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk and all of these great artists, none of them won Pulitzers.
Yeah.
So yeah, it takes them a long time to sort of come around to what people are listening to and you know what matters. This is not to denigrate all the classical artists who've won, but this is a huge step for the Pulitzers.
Yeah. All of a sudden, I'm thinking about Nina Simone as well. But let's listen to a little bit of more from Kendrick Lamar's album Damn. This is the first song on the album. It's titled Blood, and it really gets right to the issue of race and law enforcement and politics in America today. And in the song, Lamar's really telling a story about seeing a blind woman walking, and it looks like she's dropped something. He approaches her and tries to help her, and this is what we hear next.
Can I be of any assistance? Seems to me that you have lost something. I would like to help you find it. She replied, oh yes, you have lost something. You've lost your life.
Is it wickedness?
Lamar stated his views on police brutality with that line in the song, quote, and we hate the popo, want to kill us in the street, faux show.
That's from Kendrick Lamar's Blood. Renee, I mean, you know, here we are right in the middle of just in the past couple of days, right? That incident in Cambridge, we've got Philadelphia and black men being arrested just for being inside a Starbucks. I mean, it really, really hits home.
You know, it's the resonance. He's echoing exactly what's going on out there. If you think about a statement that Chuck D from Public Enemy made decades ago, you know, he called hip hop Black America's CNN. Hmm. And here we have the continuation of that with Kendrick Lamar. There's not a lot of separation between his music and exactly what people are going through and what's happening. And I think that's why it connects with people the way it did. And I do think that's part of what the Pulitzer jury connected to as well.
Yeah. Well, let's hear something else then, again, from the album Damn. This is a song called DNA. This is it right from the top.
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA. Quarter piece, got war and peace inside my DNA. I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. I got hustle, though, ambition, flow inside my DNA. I was born like this, and sworn like this, immaculate conception. I transform like this, perform like this, with Yoshi, a new weapon. I don't contemplate, I meditate, then off your head. This that put the kiss to bed. This that I got realness. I just.
So, I mean, Renee, to your point a little bit earlier about what Chuck D called hip-hop as the CNN for African-Americans, where does this particular album from Kendrick Lamar sort of fit into the broader history of hip-hop?
Well, I mean, I think it definitely aligns with albums like Public Enemies, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. You know, hip-hop has always, I mean, look, hip-hop, you know, began as party music, but it very quickly pivoted into political music. So you can go back to Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Fives, The Message. And before that, they'd been pretty much, you know, a party band, and suddenly they were talking about, you know, don't push me because I'm close to the edge. You know, that comes out in 1982, 83. We're talking, you know, 30-odd years later, not that different from what Kendrick Lamar is talking about. You know, it also speaks to the fact of, you know, things haven't changed that much. If you can still make music that's relevant about these issues, it says something about how little progress we've actually had.
Mm. So, I mean, I guess maybe you touched on this point earlier, but let me just ask you again then. Do you think the acknowledgement by the Pulitzer Committee can nudge that progress forward at all? Or is it just sort of, you know, a largely white jury of Pulitzer Committee members making themselves feel better by giving a nod to hip hop?
Well, look, I do think it makes a difference that the Pulitzer administrator for the first time is a woman and an African-American, Danny Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think already you broaden the idea of what is Pulitzer worthy when you have someone who has a wider vision that I think Dana does have. So I think it starts there. You know, I don't want the people to think this is some sort of like, you know, feel good white liberal thing. And look, we gave a hip hop artist a Pulitzer. You know, I think it's more than that. I think they understand, you know, why he's the big artist that he is, why the music he does matters. And I think that's what they want to acknowledge. I mean, this is, you know, you mentioned Nina Simone earlier. You know, this would be like Nina Simone winning the Pulitzer in 1965 for Mississippi Goddamn.
Exactly.
Or James Brown winning for Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud in 1969. You know, it captures a feeling and a mood, the joy, the angst of being an African-American.
Well, Renee Graham is a columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor, talking to us about Kendrick Lamar and the fact that just yesterday he was awarded the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for music. Renee, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And before we shift gears, I want to hear some more from Lamar's album. This is Triple X featuring U2. And again, the album is Kendrick Lamar's Damn.
New Kung Fu Kenny.
Throw a steak off the yard to a pool full of sharks, he'll take it. Leave him in the wilderness with a sworn nemesis, he'll make it. Take the gratitude from him, I bet he'll show you something. Whoa.
All right, well, moving on. There's a major case that was argued before the United States Supreme Court today, and it pits Boston-based retailer, online retailer, I should say, Wayfair, against the state of South Dakota. And at issue, whether states can require online sellers to collect state sales taxes on purchases made by their residents. Since 1992, the court has held that retailers collect such taxes only in states where they have a physical presence. Now, South Dakota wants to lower that threshold substantially to the level of a company's economic presence in a state. So the Supreme Court could be poised to make sweeping changes to online commerce and taxation in America, depending on how the justices rule. Joining us now with his view is Andy Pincus. He's a visiting lecturer at Yale Law School and a partner at the firm Mayer Brown in Washington. And he filed an amicus brief in this case on behalf of online retailers. Andy Pincus, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. Great to be with you.
So, first of all, the Supreme Court is essentially revisiting its 1992 decision in the Quill case, right? And that's the one that says that companies only need to pay sales taxes or collect them in states where they have a physical presence. But this was back in the day where we had catalogs, you know, a lifetime away from where we are now with online retailers. So why'd you file a brief on behalf of online retailers and not states? It feels like this law is in need of a massive update.
Well, because first of all, the rule that the Supreme Court adopted actually was first adopted in 1967, reaffirmed in 92, mm-hmm. and again at issue today. Because catalogs, mail order, telephone, online, it's all the same. It's covered by the same legal principle, which is you do need physical presence. And if that rule is going to be changed, we think the place for it to be changed is Congress, because lots of folks have invested money creating online businesses based on the assumption that they don't have to collect and remit taxes based on the laws of 50 states if they have customers in every state. And to change that rule in the middle, for the court to do it, would be quite a significant change for those businesses.
Mm. Now, okay, so saying that Congress should be the group in charge of changing the law, point taken, right? I mean, they, you know, should be regulating interstate commerce here. But asking that outcome to come from Congress right now seems, to be perfectly frank, a little unrealistic, since it seems hard for Congress to get anything done. But I am curious about your notion that online retailers, smaller ones, are attracted to e-commerce because they can avoid collecting state sales taxes. I mean, that's not really the only driver, obviously. The big driver is they get access to customers ostensibly anywhere in the world.
Right. It's a huge engine of entrepreneurship. And the data shows it's especially been an engine of building small businesses for women, people of color, veterans, and people who live in geographically depressed areas who may not have enough of a market in their immediate physical area to make their business work. But as you say, if they can reach the whole world via the internet, they do have a marketplace in which they can thrive. And that's that. The data indicates that disproportionately those are the people in the small and medium-sized business world that have been thriving and that are really going to be hurt by this change. Because what's happening is the big retailers, the Amazons, the Walmarts, they are moving to a bricks and clicks model where they feel like they need physical presence, either because they want warehouses for quick delivery, or Amazon, I live in Washington, D.C., and Amazon just opened a bookstore because they felt like they needed a physical place for people to go. So for the bigger companies, they're moving into a model where under the Quill rule, they are subject to tax collection obligations. So we're really talking about what are we going to do with respect to these small and medium-sized businesses, and are we going to find a way, for example, to create some kind of an exemption for small companies to be sure that the change in the rule doesn't give rise to retroactive taxation obligations? And Congress can make those fine distinctions, but the court can't. The court basically has an on-off switch.
Right.
That's about it.
So this question of fairness, right, between the online giants and smaller online retailers or sort of legacy or extant brick-and-mortar retailers in the state. I mean, because I want to play a little bit of tape for you here. This is from Bill Rennie. He's the vice president of the Retailers Association of Massachusetts. And they definitely want the Quill decision to be overturned because they're concerned about fairness regarding online sales versus brick-and-mortar retailers, you know, right here, for example, in the state of Massachusetts.
You're a brick-and-mortar retailer here in Massachusetts, and you're selling a $500 TV, you know, you're going to charge 6.25% sales tax to the customer that walks into your store. That customer can stand there right in front of you, pull out their phone, look up the exact same item online. The key is going to be that 6.25% sales tax that they don't have to pay online.
Your response to that?
But they are going to have to pay a shipping charge. You know, I think the just singling out the taxation as the sole difference just presents a very misleading picture. Brick-and-mortar stores have an advantage. The customer can walk in, see and touch the merchandise, doesn't have to pay any shipping charge. Online, yes, from a smaller retailer, there may not be tax, but there will be shipping charges, and there isn't the ability to see and touch, and there isn't, obviously, you have a remote seller. Some people prefer to have a store where if something goes wrong, they can go downtown and get the problem dealt with. So there are pluses and minuses to each experience, and I think the people who want Quill overturned want to single out one little element. But as I say, you have to look at the whole package that each is providing and recognize that the big competition is coming from the big online retailers who now are, for the most part, and the data shows, paying those taxes.
Well, you know, the Government Accountability Office had put out an audit that says that states missed out on almost $14 billion in sales taxes in 2017 because they couldn't collect from so many online retailers.
Well, I think that data was before Amazon changed its model and now collects taxes on Amazon sales. So that's going to put a big dent in that number. But the GAO study also showed that of the top 100 retailers, the sales tax owed is being collected to the tune of between 86 and 96%. So it tells you that the big companies are collecting the tax. And as I said, this is really about what are we going to do about the medium-sized and small online companies.
Okay, well, so I mean,
it's good to have Amazon or Walmart or someone as the sort of threat out there to the local merchant. But in fact, with respect to sales tax, they're not anymore.
So, but in South Dakota, though, the law that's at issue here is one that they would require retailers with more than $100,000 in annual sales in South Dakota or 200 transactions in that state. I mean, does that seem like a reasonable threshold to you if you're talking small to medium-sized businesses?
Well, the South Dakota statute is a made-for-litigation statute. They're very frank to say, we wrote this statute to make it really attractive to the Supreme Court. the legal rule that they're asking to the Supreme Court to adopt, as their lawyer candidly said today to the Supreme Court, would allow a state to choose to impose tax obligations if the state just had one sale. So the fact that South Dakota, for this litigation play, has written this statute doesn't say anything about what the other 49 okay. states could do, or frankly, what South Dakota could do after Quill were overruled.
I'm just running out of time here, and forgive me for jumping in here, but there's one last thing I want to ask you, because this case was argued before the Supreme Court today, and I'm seeing here that Justice Kennedy, for example, just a couple of years ago, he said that the legal system should find an appropriate case to reexamine Quill, because he says it's inflicting extreme harm and unfairness on the state. So does that give you sort of a window into how the court might rule here?
Well, I think it tells you why the court took the case and why the case got to the court. And I think when the Supreme Court granted review in January, South Dakota and its allies thought that they were going to have a pretty smooth path to getting Quill overturned. But the questioning of the argument today was very, very tough. Based on a lot of the issues we've been discussing. You know, when Justice Kennedy wrote that, he did not have the information about 86% to 96% of sales taxes being collected.
Yeah.
He didn't have the information about the shift to bricks and clicks, and he didn't have the information about the vulnerability of small online sellers to these kinds of costs and what would do to their businesses. So I think that, at least based on the questions at the argument, has raised a number of concerns in the minds
right.
of many of the justices,
right.
and obviously we'll see how they rule.
Well, Andy Pincus is a visiting lecturer at Yale Law School and partner at the firm Mayer Brown in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We want to take a quick look now at a huge change that could be on the horizon for Massachusetts healthcare. Two hospital systems, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Leahy Health, have proposed merging 13 different hospitals across the state. If approved, it would create Massachusetts' second largest healthcare system behind the giant Partners Healthcare. Now, the State Department of Public Health has already approved the merger, but it's still under review by the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission. And last week, we started to hear the rumblings of concern about the merger. Michael Wagner, president and CEO of Tufts Medical Center, spoke of the possible downsides of a healthcare duopoly in the state.
My concerns are that this merger will result in increased disparities, increased costs, while reducing access, especially for underserved communities.
Well, Jessica Bartlett covers healthcare for Boston Business Journal, and she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, if this merger does go through, exactly how extensive would this new hospital system be?
Well, so it's a 13-hospital system that involves five different providers, Leahy, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, New England Baptist, Mount Auburn, and Anna Jakes. So it's monumental. Now, keep in mind, though, that there's still Partners Healthcare, which is, as you said, the largest provider in Massachusetts. But this would be the second largest provider, have a quarter of all the inpatient discharges in the state, and would really create a second big health system in Massachusetts.
Right. Okay. And so in terms of reasons for the merger, what have Beth Israel and Leahy been saying? What are the positives they say they bring to the table?
Yeah, so the merging hospitals say that in this market, to better care for patients, you really need to do it on a budgeted basis. They call it population health management. And so you have to be all things to everybody to not lose patients so you can keep them in your system and better keep them on a budget. And so to do that, you need a wider service area with more specialties and skills. And they want to prevent leakage to other systems. They also say that globally in Massachusetts, from a business perspective, that having a low-cost big systems such as Leahy BI will take patients from Partners, which is the highest cost health system in the state. They say if patients are coming to them rather than Partners, that'll reduce healthcare spending in Massachusetts, which has been the long established goal.
Right. And I mean, Partners is so large, right, that they have enormous clout when it comes to negotiating prices with insurers. Now, the Department of Public Health has issued a go-ahead for the merger, but they look into patient advocacy, for example. On the other hand, though, we're still waiting for the Health Policy Commission to have its say, and that's the state agency that's aimed at reducing healthcare costs and improving quality. So could this proposed merger run into challenges there?
Yeah, so the Health Policy Commission is really the state's health care watchdog. They don't have any authority to stop any mergers, but they're the ones who do the analysis to say, will this raise health care spending in Massachusetts? And so what they're doing now is analyzing this deal, and if they find that it will raise health care spending in Massachusetts, they can send it to the Attorney General, who could then sue to stop the merger. Now, this took a similar turn when partners tried to acquire South Shore Hospital and Emerson Hospital and Hallmark Health a couple years ago, and there was wide outcry about that. But the Health Policy Commission hasn't necessarily said that they feel this is definitely going to raise healthcare spending in the state, but it is going to enough so that they have to analyze it.
Got it. Well, Jessica Bartlett covers healthcare for Boston Business Journal. Jessica, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
Now, there's still a lot of questions around the proposed Beth Israel Lahey merger, but if it goes through, it's one of the many consolidations, hospital consolidations going on across America. As the magazine Modern Healthcare put it last year, 2017 marked a year of mergers, and that doesn't really appear to be slowing down anytime soon. So let's get a sense as to what impact all of these hospital mergers have had in the healthcare markets where they're taking place. Joining me now is Elizabeth Rosenthal. She's editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News. She's also the author of the 2017 book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Dr. Rosenthal, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me again.
Okay, so first of all, I mean, just give us the big picture here. I think we hear this constant tension when it comes to mergers of any kind, let alone in healthcare. There's the tension between it'll bring costs down because we have two big competitors versus it's just going to raise costs because we only have two big competitors. So how has that actually played out in the healthcare field?
Sure. The narrative is, you know, we'll join together and we're going to be more efficient and we'll be a more effective competitor in this case to partners or your other health systems. And you know what? When these mergers first started, back in the 80s and 90s, it seemed true for a while because it didn't make sense for every hospital to purchase its own drugs and its own gowns, and there was a level of efficiency gained. But now, you know, that narrative has continued, but what we've seen in practice is study after study shows the effect of these mergers. They're so big and so powerful and often result in one or two or maybe three huge behemoths in each market, that the overwhelming result is to just raise prices.
Okay.
That's been shown again and again. And when you look, what's really concerning is when you look at, there was a study that looked at over 300 health markets in the United States, and it showed that today none of them are highly competitive. And over one half of them were highly concentrated with only one or two systems dominating.
Can I just
and
jump
I
in
think
here?
That's
Wait.
What we're seeing emerging.
So, because you just, that's kind of a remarkable number. 300 healthcare markets in the United States, and how many of them were not highly competitive? None of them.
None of them were highly competitive.
Okay.
You know, I went to medical school in Boston, and when I went to medical school in Boston, there were, you know, 7, 8, 9 systems, hospitals. Now they've all joined to kind of have two huge systems that have incredible pricing power. And I know, you know, there's this narrative. I think we heard that they're avowing they're going to be the low-cost alternative. Well, none of these hospitals shows you their prices. So how do you know that? Why are they going to be low-cost?
Well, I have to say, in the case of Massachusetts, for example, through Blue Cross Blue Shield, the insurer, patients know because they can look it up in terms of how Blue Cross views the pricing of the hospitals, you know, high cost
right.
versus low cost. And that makes me wonder, you know, because insurers are doing that, they're trying to do whatever they can to steer folks towards lower cost options. Is part of the attraction in these mergers, if you create a larger, you know, a consolidated behemoth, you possibly bring patients back in because they have nowhere else to go.
Yes, but is that a good way if we're supposed to be patient consumers to shop around for better deals? No. I mean, you have no choice, right? You go to whatever the local system is. And yes, maybe your insurer will direct you to the lower cost of the two big behemoths. But if there are only two of them, the likely scenario is they're both pretty happy overcharging.
Hmm. Well, I just want to get a little bit more from you on the in terms of the scale of some of the mergers that we're seeing here. I see that one of the largest recent mergers between Ascension and Providence St. Joseph Health, they're talking about merging. And if that goes through, that could create a 191 hospital colossus. Is that right? In 27 states?
Yes, that's right. And if, you know, people are worried about, for example, Amazon having too much control over our lives. I mean, this is our healthcare. And if you have one huge health system that operates in all these states, they're going to have incredible power in determining your treatment, determining which drugs you can get, and in bargaining with your insurer to make sure they get good prices. I mean, there are interesting cases playing out in Boston. We see there's a lawsuit that was just brought by the California Attorney General against Sutter Health, which is a huge healthcare system there, averring that this health system, with its pricing power, has raised prices beyond what is reasonable and good for consumers.
But, you know, even there are healthcare professionals who don't necessarily see they don't have concerns about these mergers. They see the positives, right? I mean, I'm looking at Stephen Strongwater, president and CEO of Atrius Health, a physicians group. He says that the creation of another large integrated healthcare system in Massachusetts will result in increased competition because you have a larger group of hospitals that can go toe-to-toe with Partners Healthcare, essentially. And that would result in market pressure to lower costs overall. Is he wrong?
Well, we'll see how that plays out. You know, that hasn't worked that way in other markets. So I think every healthcare market is individual. I mean, what's encouraging in the sense is, you know, Beth Israel Deaconess, that system, it's another Harvard health system, right? So it's another really high quality health system. Maybe if they're motivated to bring down prices, that will work. But if they're motivated to, you know, improve their bottom line and make more money and, you know, build some more buildings and pay doctors more, that will happen. So it's all about the motivation. And what the problem is in creating these huge healthcare systems, you're trusting on the motivation, not on the market, to do the right thing.
Now, how much are these mergers the way, I don't want to say the way out, but maybe the possibly the only way forward for some of these hospital groups? Because I'm seeing here that, for example, the CARE Group, which is the parent organization for Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, reported a $3.1 million operating loss, operating loss, I should say, for fiscal 2017. So mergers might be the way to get some efficiencies out of the system so they can be back in the black.
Well, I guess what I tell people when they tell me, well, the hospitals are struggling, they're losing money, is I say, go walk into the lobby of one of these hospitals and tell me if it looks like a place that's hurting. What I think we've seen is hospitals say, oh, we're losing money. But at the same time as they say they're losing money, they're buying new machines that perhaps are not needed. They're putting in marble lobbies. They're doing, you know, high thread count sheets. So I guess the question I have when hospitals tell me we're losing money is maybe you're spending money on the wrong things. That is not to say there aren't hospitals that are really struggling. They're mostly rural hospitals.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sorry to cut you off there, but I still just want to underscore something you said earlier, that you can't point to a healthcare market where these consolidations have happened, where things have gotten more competitive, right?
Not where they've been studied. So, you know, maybe in a few years, people will be studying the Boston market and saying, hey, it worked here. But so far, the evidence is against that.
Well, Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A little earlier today, we caught up with Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. Lots to discuss with her. From her office's recent wins in federal court and the state Supreme Judicial Court, to the matter of maintaining the public trust amid ongoing scandals at the Massachusetts State Police. We started with one of her wins. Late last week, the state's highest court handed Healey a major victory over ExxonMobil. The energy company had refused to comply with the attorney general's investigation into whether Exxon misled the public and investors about fossil fuels and climate change. So I asked Healey for her reaction when the SJC on Friday ruled that Exxon must comply with her investigation.
Well, I was really pleased because it's been frustrating. For the last 2 years, Exxon has fought us at every turn in our efforts to conduct an investigation into what Exxon knew when about climate change. We sent subpoenas to Exxon, and instead of producing documents to us and answering questions, they fought us in court and tried to shut down our investigation. Two big wins. We got recently one out of New York and one out of the Supreme Judicial Court here in Massachusetts that said, the AG is allowed to ask these questions, comply with the investigation, Exxon, move over and produce the documents. And, you know, it was very affirming to know that we're asking the right questions and that we're entitled to ask these questions. And frankly, the public deserves to know.
So, you know, what's interesting, especially about the SJC's ruling here, is that the SJC has said, yes, your office has jurisdiction to ask for these documents. And that, I found that to be really kind of a precedent-setting ruling? Because when talking about climate change, it's like stuff that happens everywhere. Exxon was saying that it didn't necessarily have any activities that had a direct impact on Massachusetts. I wonder if it opens the door to the Attorney General's office, you know, investigating other companies for big global issues like this.
What the SJC ruled was essentially to affirm the authority we've always had. This was, in our view, a pretty routine investigation. What was so unusual, though, was Exxon's response. They sued us multiple times in multiple jurisdictions to try to shut us down. They claimed a First Amendment corporate free speech right, which was rejected by the court. And they took a really unusual position by saying that they actually don't do business here in Massachusetts when there are Exxon gas stations all over the place. So in our view, it was pretty straightforward. It was a unanimous decision, but an important decision. Unfortunately, what we're seeing, though, more from certain corporations is an effort to fight our authority in court. Remember a few months ago, my office sued Equifax over that massive data breach. Equifax's response was to take us to court and say, you don't have any authority to investigate us. And the court soundly rejected that and came down on our side, which and said, of course, the Attorney General has the right to investigate allegations of consumer protection law violations. So, you know, I hope we don't see more of this, but unfortunately, that's been the pattern here. And fortunately, the courts continue to side with us on this, as they should, because at the end of the day, if state AGs don't have the authority to do investigations, to look into allegations of civil or criminal violations, then we're going to be in deep trouble, especially when the federal government isn't doing it.
So I want to ask you about another win that your office has had, that a federal judge ruled that the Massachusetts ban on assault-style weapons is constitutional, and that your crackdown, if I can call it that, on copycat weapons and the like that are similar to assault-style weapons is also constitutional. So This was another
important victory for our office last week. Again, you know, similar to Exxon, the NRA and the gun lobby has been fighting me and my office at every turn when it comes to enforcing gun laws here in Massachusetts. And the NRA and the gun lobby took the position that my enforcement of our state's assault weapons ban was unconstitutional. Last week, a federal district court judge here in Massachusetts ruled that not only do we have the authority to enforce the law, but the law is constitutional and that assault weapons and large capacity magazines are not protected by the Second Amendment. Importantly, the judge was writing according to the Heller decision, which is guiding Supreme Court precedent. This was the case decided years ago, authored by Justice Scalia. And basically, here, as appropriate, the court followed Supreme Court precedent and ruled in our favor and said that the AG's office was absolutely within its rights and in enforcing the law. To me, it's important because for so long, the NRA has been trying to rewrite the rules and looking to try to stop us at every turn. You know, they fought us on the right of police chiefs here in the state to make decisions, suitability decisions about whether or not somebody should get a gun permit. They continue to challenge basic laws that we have in place that, you know, frankly, account for some of the numbers. Massachusetts has among the lowest, if not the lowest, rate of gun deaths in the country. Assault weapons bans are a component, but make no mistake about it, I think that red flag laws are important. I think we need to change the laws that allow better sharing of data between and among law enforcement so we can track guns, particularly the flow of illegal guns. We need to allow the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to actually study gun violence prevention strategies to help us inform policies and the like. So there are a lot of things we need to do in addition to universal background checks, of course, but this was an important victory last week, and I was, needless to say, pleased about it. It affirmed our right to enforce state laws here, and in this instance, laws that are on the books that are really about public safety.
Well, that brought us to the much more thorny issue of Healey's office's role in investigating the Massachusetts State Police and its ongoing scandal regarding overtime pay. The AG's office is looking into possible criminal charges against 21 state troopers who were discovered billing for overtime hours without actually showing up for those patrols. However, several weeks ago, Gregory Sullivan, former Massachusetts Inspector General, told us at Radio Boston that he doesn't believe the AG's office should be handling the inquiry because the Attorney General's investigators in such matters are Massachusetts state troopers, who would, in effect, be charged with investigating their colleagues. Healey says she disagrees with that concern.
First of all, this is a criminal investigation. Only the Attorney General's office has grand jury power. And for any criminal investigation, you need to have that authority. Moreover, we regularly do investigations and bring action in the space of public integrity. It's something that we do, and I think do well. And thirdly, I have no qualms whatsoever about the investigators and troopers in my office, their ability to carry out investigations and do their job. That's the way it has been. That's the way it will continue to be. And it's important that we as an office, the Attorney General's office, the chief legal office in the state, chief law enforcement officer in the state, have the prerogative and exercise it when there are issues of public integrity. And when the public has questions, it's really, really important.
But regarding the matter of maintaining the public trust, I pressed Healey and asked her about her office's handling of disgraced former state drug lab chemist Sonia Farrick. Now, last week, the state's highest court dismissed more than 11,000 convictions in cases tainted by Farrick. That's a decision that Healey applauds. But in 2017, a Springfield judge issued a scathing ruling saying that in addition to Farrick's actions, there was evidence of prosecutorial misconduct by two assistant attorneys general who worked in the office before Healey became AG. A year before that, though, in 2016, Healey had appointed two independent investigators to look into those prosecutorial misconduct charges. She picked retired judges Peter Valis and Thomas Merrigan, who then asked two Massachusetts State Police troopers to do the actual investigation. On March 31st, 2016, they submitted their report and found, quote, "After our thorough review, we agree that there is no evidence of prosecutorial misconduct or obstruction of justice by the assistant attorneys general and Massachusetts state police officers in matters of the Farrick case." But a year later, a Springfield judge strongly disagreed, saying not only was there prosecutorial misconduct in those cases, but that their actions amounted to a fraud against the court. So I asked Attorney General Healey, in the matter of integrity and the state criminal justice system, can the public trust reports coming out of her office?
That was not a report by our office. What our office did at the time was ask a a judge, a former judge, to independently evaluate. And that was something I didn't need to do, by the way. But he conducted his evaluation. We've been clear, though, separate and apart from that as an office. In fact, we filed recently in the Supreme Judicial Court our statement on Farrakh. What we have said from the beginning is that this is a matter of significance. We supported the dismissal of thousands of cases. That's what our paper said the other day. We've worked very hard as an office to advocate for the reforms to make sure this never, ever happens again. What happened in this case was terrible in terms of what Sonia Farrakh did. And we've accepted the court's findings about the conduct of two assistant attorneys general who worked under the prior administration. So I've made a real effort to try to undertake and advocate for the kinds of reforms that I think defendants are entitled to, which include most recently this week in court advocating for the dismissal of thousands of cases. And so I think it's important that, you know, whenever there are allegations like this, that they're addressed and that we meet them head on. And that's what I've certainly tried to do from this office.
But just so that I have my facts straight, I mean, you appointed Judge Velez, right, to do that independent.
We hired them. You know, I took office, let's see, in January 15. I think that there was a decision that came out of the Supreme Judicial Court a few months later that then initiated a look back at what had happened in these Farrakh cases. And one of the early things I did was to do an internal review here and also to ask for someone, an independent former judge, to undertake his review. Now, I did not control the scope of that investigation or what he looked at, and it turned out that there was more information out there, which was brought before the court. Mm-hmm. And the important thing here is that I think that process worked, and we were able to, through that process, have a full explication of everything that happened.
Because of advocates for people who had been wrongfully charged.
Certainly, they're the ones, right? Yeah, no, and we've supported.
Because the Velez report, they didn't subpoena anybody or take any, you know, didn't question anybody
under
oath.
That was a small portion of what was a much larger evidentiary hearing. So we put a lot of people who used to work in the Attorney General's office on the stand. We put current employees on the stand as well. And, you know, we really participated in a really extensive way to get out what needed to get out about what happened. Because the important thing is that the right steps are taken to ensure that bad things don't happen again and that there's accountability in the system. And I've said from the beginning that was important to me as Attorney General. And I think that if you look at what we filed before the SJC this week, you'll see that reflected, that not only have we undertaken reforms and encouraged reforms, we've also, for the defendant's benefit and what they're entitled to, advocated for the dismissal of thousands and thousands of cases.
So to be clear, because advocates for some of the people bound up in those cases, they want every case from the Hinton Lab dismissed while Farrakh was there, whether or not she directly signed off on it. Is that something that you would
That's
support?
That's right. And we've supported the dismissal of the vast majority of cases. Many of these cases, fortunately, have been dismissed, including some as recently as a few weeks ago. But my hope with this filing is that we'll see the dismissal of the resulting vast majority of cases that are left.
Yeah. It's interesting because vast majority is not exactly the same thing as what you know, folks like Matt Siegel at the ACLU are calling for, because they're concerned that that Farrakh was known to have tampered with evidence that other chemists were working on. So they just want to see all of them dismissed.
Right. Well, we've actually said is that for a period of time where it could not be established that she was not involved in the lab, we've argued for and supported the advocates in the dismissal of those cases. There is a time period outside of that, though, where we think it's fair for the court to take it all in and decide. And again, we'll have to see what the court decides here, yeah, hopefully in the coming weeks.
You know, mentioning Matt Siegel at the ACLU, again, going back to the actions of the former assistant attorney generals from, again, before your time as attorney general. But he has recently said that regarding that prosecutorial misconduct, he doesn't see any remedy yet for that misconduct having come out of your office. And I just wanted to get your response to that.
Well, I don't know what he's seen or not seen. I know we have undertaken extensive action in terms of ethics trainings, prosecutorial trainings, establishment of an ethics committee, and any number of other steps. This is something that I took personally very seriously, as you can imagine, when I came into office and continue to do so, our team does. This is about ensuring that we have the systems in place that work. That's the only way our criminal justice system is going to function, is if it's functioning properly and everybody's doing their job. And where they haven't done their job, part of my job is to make sure that that happens going forward.
Attorney General Maura Healey, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Great to see you. Great to be with you.
And we spoke with Attorney General Healey a little earlier today at her offices. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.